Box taking. Have a blinking ground level light. You are go. Order systems, go. Mercury capsule, go.
Welcome along to this week's Hills Radio presentation of Astrospace News with yours truly, Bill Hodson, and the man behind Astrospace News, David Renicky.
All pre-start final lights are correct. The ready light is on. Eject Mercury umbilical. Oil evacuate.
Mercury umbilical clear.
Mercury is
evacuate. Lights on.
All recorders to fast. T-minus 18 seconds and counting engine start.
Each week, we get to hitch a ride with Dave and have a look at those weird, wild, and breaking news stories from space, across the cosmos, and around the world. Via streaming audio from hillsradio.com and davidrenicky.com.
Good morning, Dave. Wonderful to have you along, man.
Bill, good to be with you again, and it's a nice morning here. We've got nice clear skies for a change too.
Excellent news, and some very interesting news about China moving to build a spacecraft that's going to be a very, very big one, but Dave, it may not be for people. What's going on here?
Well, it may be, Bill. This is something that is right out of 1950s science fiction. China, as we know, are very proactive in space. In fact, they're one of the main leading forces now in space exploration. This is quite a change from having the Soviet Union and America, you know, combatants in what we saw was the moon race. But look, this is a new idea that what they want to do is to put a very large platform or a space station in space. But they're talking about something that could be up to 5 kilometers in diameter or length. Now, this is pretty interesting. When you look at it, it could be in corkscrew fashion, I don't know. But when I saw this, it reminded me of something I read about in the 70s and the 80s from a man by the name of Gerard O'Neill. Long gone now, we lost him to cancer many years ago, but Gerard O'Neill was one of the unsung heroes of the space program and a writer, very skilled writer, and a futurist. He liked to look at how things may be in times to come, how we travel in space. How will we live in space? One of the ideas he had was a floating city. When I saw this story, I immediately sort of was drawn back to that and the drawings that he made at the time of hundreds, maybe even thousands of people. Need I say, or dare I say, millions of people living on these huge floating cities outside the Earth's atmosphere. China are looking at doing that very thing, piecemeal, bit by bit. And if they do, well, look, you know, this could quite possibly work. It would take a long time to do that, but they do have an aging population, but also they're overpopulating their country, and they probably need to shovel a few of them up there. But it would certainly be a place where you could live quite easily, quite conveniently, in low Earth orbit there, and properly designed structures there that would shield you from the radiation and the heat from the sun and you know, meteorite impacts, etc. The drawings I saw when I read this story just came to mind, and it is possible. At the moment, very, very difficult to do because of the amount of time you needed to do it, but China are moving ahead in leaps and bounds, and I wouldn't discount anything they're capable of doing.
And that's a very wise state of mind. When I first heard about such a thing, Heinlein came to mind, and Asimov.
Yeah.
In some respects. And there was the Matt Damon movie, Elysium, also came to mind. Are we considering structures of that sort of magnitude, Dave?
Yeah. It's hard to really answer that question because it's so speculative. And it's an engineering project that would require a huge amount of effort. It's a long-term thing. I think in the mainstream, well, when we look at it, in the interim, between now and then, we know they are building another space station here closer by, which is going to be quite useful for what they want to do. They want to end up mining the moon. They want a base on the moon like everyone else does. They're going to get involved with space tourism and space mining of asteroids and things like this, and then want to go to Mars. It's an interesting stopping-off point. I would say that by the year 2050, we're going to have two or three of these orbiting space stations up there, each run by different consortia groups, if you will, maybe countries. You know. But this is a step beyond that. It's something very futuristic, and who knows, down the track, close to the end of the century, it may be become a reality. But boy, it could be done. There's nothing technically impossible about it, which is interesting. It's what Gerard O'Neill wrote about. And he would be jumping with joy if he would see this idea. Anyway, look, everything's happening. Space is opening up in so many different areas, as we're seeing now. And we're talking about it's all done now through this new involvement with these tech entrepreneurs, these multi-billionaires like Musk and Bezos and Richard Branson and people like him. So the space programs all collectively are moving in a different direction, no longer government controlled, private enterprise moving in there, so things are going to shift along really quick now. I'm quite keen on it. If we can, you know, if we can live this out, we don't wipe ourselves out, we've got a pretty good future.
It does sound fascinating, and Australia is not being left behind, Dave. There's a little whisper that West Australia have their own homegrown spacecraft ready for liftoff.
Yeah, it flew the other day. It's called Binar, B-I-N-A-R, and that's Aboriginal for Noongar people for fireball. Let's go now to Stephen Thomas from 10 News, talking about the Binar 1 satellite.
SpaceX's Falcon 9 rocket made history when it blasted off in May last year, the first time a private company had launched astronauts into orbit. When the Falcon 9 takes off again this Saturday, it will make history once more with this small but mighty cargo, WA's first fully homegrown spacecraft, the Binar 1.
West Australia State Premier Mark McGowan.
Smaller than I expected. It's obviously very powerful.
Binar is Noongar for fireball, and the 1.5-kilogram probe has taken Curtin University 3 years to build.
Curtin University's Head of Earth and Planetary Sciences, Professor Phil Bland.
We're at the start of a program now of WA putting hardware, putting its own spacecraft into orbit that can help WA industry.
From the International Space Station, the satellite will be released into low orbit to collect data that will go towards an ambitious goal to have WA-built spacecraft on the moon by 2025.
The ones that we're thinking of sending to the moon will be kind of six of those, about the size of a cereal box.
The Binar will capture images of Australia during its 18-month orbit of Earth.
The first of, I think, seven satellites that Curtin University has created and that will be launched into space to do various tasks.
But for now, it's T-minus 5 days until the first one launches from NASA's Kennedy Space Center. Stephen Thomas for 10 News First.
Now, this is a CubeSat launched by West Australia's Curtin University over there, you know quite well. Built by the staff and the students. So it's only about the size of a tissue box, Bill. It's not very big, weighing about 2 kilos. There's a lot of technology in it. These are called CubeSats, and you can buy multiple CubeSats if you want to. The experiment got launched on SpaceX from Elon Musk from Cape Canaveral, but in the nose cone were other people's experiments as well. But our people were there, the Australian contingent, watching it, and it went off like a dream. It's now in orbit. And in a little while, they'll park at about 400K from here, and it'll start sending back information. It's just a test, an example of what we can do in the future by offering the rest of the world our technology and our capability of building and maintaining satellites and launching them eventually from Australia, because we've got our own Australian Space Agency now, which is up and running. I'm quite keen on it. I think it's about time. We're about 4 or 5 decades too late, but thank God we got there eventually.
Oh, yes.
It's a big hand clap for this group of people who are working so closely. This satellite, by the way, is multifunctional, but one of the things it will do, it'll map the coastline of Australia a little bit more accurately than what we can do now. That's one of its jobs.
Brilliant work. And let's not forget that back in the day we had WRESat. I know you've mentioned that.
Oh, you know about that.
Yeah, yes, a couple of times before. Well, it was pretty much on my back door, Dave, because we were an Air Force family and we lived...
At Woomera.
Yep, well, exactly. One of my brothers served at Woomera, and the Weapons Research Establishment, which was the leap-off for that program, as the British were doing the last of their test work as well.
You know, at one stage, we were number three in the world. We were launching, as you probably know, rockets from Woomera for the British. We launched the Bruce Streak from there. We've also, like you said, we launched our own satellite called RESAT, WRESAT, Weapons Research and Establishment. But sadly now, you know, and you'll understand when I say it how sad it is that the name Woomera doesn't resonate with anyone anymore when you talk about that type of activity that we had. We had a city there at one stage. People from all over the world were coming and living and working here. But you mentioned Woomera, wherever you go overseas now, and everyone, you know, connects it with a detention centre.
Oh, yes, which is a real shame.
Yeah.
It is.
Lost a piece of history there, but I'm glad you mentioned that, and Woomera is something that we should have been proud of, and we should have continued it. We could have had a burgeoning space business decades ago, but they just let it go.
Well, we threw our hand in with the American program, providing tracking, and once we reached Apollo, it was vital. Tidbinbilla and Parkes were essential.
That's exactly right. I'm glad you mentioned that, because we did end up being the backbone of the American space program, not only for the moon landing, but as you said, you know, Tidbinbilla is still tracking Voyager.
Yes, can you believe it? And the strength of that signal has been compared to looking for a pushbike light from the distance on the moon.
Oh, that's being generous. It's 1/1,000,000th of a watt.
Yes, exactly.
And you're in radio. You know that your radio signal, your transmitter there is in watts. The big one's around 50,000 watts.
Yes.
I think our little community radio station down here would only be in the 20 or maybe 30 bracket. I don't know. I'm not a technician. But 1/1,000,000th of a watt, and that signal coming back. And you can understand why those dishes, those radio dishes, are so big, Bill. But they collect that signal, and the little doover at the top there, in the spike there, that amplifies it, doesn't it?
It does.
Control room.
Yeah, it's a dedicated shack, basically a preamp.
Bill, just before you go, I've been asked by quite a few mums and dads, we're in lockdown, the kids need a little bit of tuition. There's a lot of homeschooling going on. I put together a space pack, an educational pack that I think your listeners might be interested in. It's a little fundraiser for our astronomy group. We're not making much out of it at all, just to cover our costs. And it's got a lot of colouring in sheets and production sheets in there and activity sheets, you name it, fact sheets. We've got a pair of solar glasses in there and a whole bunch of stuff to keep them occupied for probably days on end. And you can photocopy those and reuse them. So we've got those on my website now. If anyone is interested in those, they're only $15. And we'll send it out to you. DavidRenneke.com. DavidRenneke.com.
All right, sir. Well, we'll catch you up next week for a lot more astrospace news. And it's been great fun.
All right, Bill. Catch you soon.
Thanks, man. Bye for now. Cheers.
Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous.